Hello and welcome to Runway Girl Network in Conversation, a deep dive into aviation and the passenger experience. I'm RGN Deputy Editor John Walton, and today I'm in conversation with CNN Aviation Editor John Ostrower. John, welcome to In Conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So, how did you first get involved in aviation? How did you get the bug?
I think I was born, actually. It sort of was always with me. I've always loved anything that flew since my earliest days. And through a bunch of crazy twists and turns, ended up writing a blog called Flight Blogger. Joined Flight Global back in 2007. Spent 4 years with Flight International. And moved from there to the Wall Street Journal covering Boeing and aircraft development and chronicling the saga of the 787 development all the way through, and joined CNN at the end of 2016. So it's been sort of a lifelong path for me through through aviation, but really the last 10 have been spent professionally, and it's more fun than I ever could possibly imagine.
Couldn't agree more. And indeed, we have you on to talk about aircraft today, and airframers in particular, especially the fast-developing relationship between Airbus and Bombardier and Boeing and Embraer. But first, thanks to our sponsor. In Conversation is brought to you by Bolteron, a Simona company, purveyor of high-performance thermoplastics for tomorrow's aircraft interiors. Specializing in an extensive range of film and sheet products tailored to the requirements of the aerospace industry, Bolteron is dedicated to providing consistent, high-quality materials, advanced performance solutions, and meeting evolving trends in aircraft interior design. Learn more at boltaron.com. John, first let's talk definitions. What exactly are the C-Series and the Embraer E-Jet? Are they small airliners? Are they big regional jets? Are they their own category? What are we calling them these days?
Well, it really depends where you live. In the United States, they are small airliners. In Europe, they can be considered big regional jets. And certainly at various corners of the performance envelope, they're in a category of their own. And that presents a lot of interesting challenges for the competition, and also trying to define them, because there are also legal ramifications with that as it relates to the ITC, which I'm sure we'll get into later on in the conversation. So, on the small end, the E175 E2 is a step up from where Embraer has been on 76 seat regional jets with the U.S. major airlines. It is a heavier aircraft, it's a bigger aircraft with more seats, but it really holds in that sort of 80 plus seat range, all the way to 144-ish on the E195 E2. And so you've got this really kind of substantial range, but notably it stops right short of where Boeing is, on the, what was once the 737-700, now the 737, MAX 7. Bombardier, on the other hand, goes from about 100 all the way to 160, depending on the density of the airplane. You know, you've got, essentially the ability to do, you know, high frequency, high density, low cost, or on the bottom end, you've got the ability to fly theoretically nonstop, with, you know, just around 40 seats, 40 business class seats, all the way from London City to New York. So you've got airplanes that really kind of touch all these different, you know, product niches. But the bottom line is no one's really sure how big the market is for airplanes this size. It's really been an open question thus far.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that market is slightly distorted in the United States with the scope clause. Can you give our listeners who might not be familiar with that just a little potted guide to what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So scope clause is an arrangement between the regional airlines and the mainline carriers restricting the size of the airplane that regional carriers can fly at a given, presumably lower cost structure than the mainline airline. So in the U.S., that's capped off at a given weight target, but it's also held off at 76 seats. So what you actually get with a 76-seat regional jet is a considerable amount of comfort in a package that's actually made for much larger capacity. So in Europe and other places, you see over 80 plus seats on E175E2, but in the US, you actually have a much more comfortable arrangement. So, you know, scope clause may be a frustration for various parts of the business, but from a passenger perspective, it has actually been a pretty good development for our needs.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that one of the best ways you can fly around the US, particularly in economy, is down the back of an E-jet one these days, right? But so what is it that prevents this scope clause being renegotiated? Why can't airlines just go to their pilots and say, look, planes are getting bigger. We want to fly more of these larger regional jets, small airliners, using our contract and subsidiary carriers?
Well, you know, it like anything, it's a lot of labor politics. What's happening here there is a shortage of pilots on top of this. So that's making things considerably harder. The natural desire is to start using bigger and bigger airplanes to fly a larger number of people with the same number of pilots on smaller, less frequent routes. So, as pilots are in short supply, airlines certainly want to be, giving the regionals either greater options in terms of what they can fly. Because frankly, when you notch up to, this sort of 100 seat market, what we've seen is that there's been a challenge for airplane makers, and airlines to effectively, take advantage of the economics of an airplane that size. Because again, from a US perspective, you're pulling down more expensive pilots into flying a smaller airplane. So you've got less ability to spread those costs. And the reverse of this is that what we've seen is that the successful 100-seaters, 120-seaters, are all derivatives. And you look at a 717, for example, which was not successful on its first go around, fresh from the factory. It is a fundamentally derivative aircraft, but really didn't get to a price point that any airline could make it work until it became a secondhand airplane. And we see that with Delta all over the US right now. Every 100-seat, successful 100-seater before that has been, either a shrink or a stretch of a pre-existing airplane. And so in pursuit of that market, one of the big selling points that Bombardier has talked about is that, well, we finally have a point designed airplane that can operate in the 100 to 125, 30 seat range, that is tailor made for that category. But again, the problem for Bombardier is that new airplanes are really expensive. And finding a cost structure that matches with that is really challenging for a lot of the airlines, and especially when we see more used airplanes coming on the market. Certainly that category is shrinking because those airplanes are just getting older, but there's also the push and pull tension of being able to get your investment back on an all new aircraft program. And whether or not they can charge a price that matches with the cost to build the airplane, which leads us to probably how we got into the ITC in the first place and the price Delta paid.
Yes, exactly. Because we're recording this the day before the US ITC is due to make its final ruling, we believe, given that we're not entirely sure what the appeals process is if it doesn't go Bombardier's way. I think most of us are probably bracing. Oh, well, don't let me put words in your mouth. What do you think is likely to happen?
Well, there was a report this morning from Reuters saying that the Canadian government is expecting to lose. It's worth noting that a tie on the Commission of Four actually goes to Boeing, the petitioner, by virtue of past precedent and how the commission operates. But where we go from here is still a gigantic open question. What needs to be settled, and whether or not the ITC will clarify this once it finally releases their explanation for why it voted the way it did, is whether or not airplanes assembled in Mobile would still be subject to that tariff. Boeing vociferously and enthusiastically believes that no, an airplane built in Mobile is still an airplane that has unfairly benefited from countervailing duties and price dumping and subsidies. Therefore, it should still apply. Boeing's position on this is not necessarily the final decision on it, though. That's going to be a huge question. And ultimately, what then becomes of this kind of outstanding relationship between Boeing and Embraer that's been forged, and obviously what has already been announced in terms of the 50.01% plan later this year to tie up the C-Series program and Airbus. So, you know, we are in a period of monumental changes in terms of the landscape for commercial airplanes. And it's a very exciting, very consequential time.
I couldn't agree more. Now, let's take a quick step back. You mentioned the 717, which is, of course, an eventual derivative of the Douglas DC-9 from the 60s. Much as the 737 is in some ways the same aircraft from the 1960s as well. How do Boeing and Airbus compete in this segment? What are their offers for this sort of 100 to 150-seater market?
Well, I think if you ask Tom Enders, he would say they have no interest in that market. And he was asked point blank when they announced the arrangement between Airbus and Bombardier about what's the effect on the A319neo, obviously an airplane that is still very much in development. But has a very tiny pool of orders. He said, well, we haven't really sold one since 2012. That should tell you everything you need to know. And I think like any airplane maker, like any smart airplane maker, you want to sell the bigger airplane. And in Airbus's case, you want to be selling A321neos, not A319neos, because the marginal cost to build a 320 versus a 321 is effectively negligible when you can charge a higher price for a 321. And by the way, the same is true for every aircraft maker. Certainly Boeing's desire to build the 787-10 was driven by, you know, the need and the desire to sell an airplane, a bigger airplane that was more expensive to airlines. And that's important. And so coming back to that, if the only way you can make a market work is on a derivative, but the derivatives that you have, either the 737-600, the A318, which frankly hasn't rolled off Airbus's production lines in years in the form of a passenger airplane, it's pretty much, they don't really want to be there, but they are looking for ways to expand their pie because there is a market there. No one's quite sure how big it is. There's a great debate there, but they would ultimately be foolish not to at least virtually try to extend their reach into that market.
That's something that's always struck me around the way that that Boeing and Airbus in particular size their, their family anchor model. What is the standard model of a 737 or an A320 family aircraft, and how will that change? I don't think there's a lot of money betting against an A322 derivative at some point. Does that mean that the A321neo becomes the sort of standard family member, and the A320 is the quote unquote shrink there? It's a really interesting perspective, but I mean, apart from corporate politics, does Boeing really believe that its 737 aircraft have been competing in the same market as these sort of large regional jet, small airliner?
They do, but it's not necessarily an argument that certainly airlines have wanted to hear. I mean, if you look at just buying behavior and what Delta has said about why they went with 717 and subsequently C-Series, that they really break it down into, you know, 20, 25 seat increments for effectively taking their enormous scale as an airline and matching the frequency with the right size airplane. And in that particular case, you know, the way in which Boeing was able to compete for that deal was they offered, ironically enough, Air Canada's used E190s, which they got through their 737 MAX deal. And they pretty much said, Delta pretty much said, no thanks. That's not what we're looking for. So in the way in which Boeing sees the MAX 7 is very important, because when they repositioned it a few years back with two more rows of seats, that allowed the company to put on, from a fan chart perspective, put the per seat fuel burn right on top of the C series. But they had to add 12 more seats to do it. And that ultimately then notched the airplane up into what could be seen as a new category. But then again, Southwest, being the stalwart 737-700 operator they are, now heavily on the used side, getting tremendous numbers of refurbished airplanes, hasn't necessarily wanted to go in that direction. And, you know, we've seen that them with deferring the MAX 7 and ultimately, again, preferring, an airplane that is point designed or point optimized for, you know, the MAX 8 sized airplane. And Boeing knows that. They've said up and down that they believe the heart of the 737 market is still the MAX 8. And so, you know, we're left to look at the data, and the data, as far as it shows right now, is that the C series and the MAX 7 are not considered in the same conversation from when airlines are looking to buy, despite what Boeing says.
Yeah. I mean, if you're creating a clean sheet airliner here, where do you put the increments, right? To what extent, for example, do you aim for the 50-seat increments rather than 25-seat increments, purely from a staffing cost perspective?
So are you thinking clean sheet single aisle, clean sheet sub 100, clean sheet below 150, clean sheet twin? I mean, where are you putting that line?
Yeah, so basically I'm thinking replacement for the A320 and the 737. Right? At what point do you say, okay, we're going to pitch this at 150 and 200, and then maybe somehow get a stretch to 250? Or do you take that delta approach and do you try and be more granular in it?
Well, it depends on the airline model, I think. You know, if you're a Spirit, for example, today, or a Frontier, you know, you're looking for the largest possible airplane, or the smallest possible airplane with the largest number of seats. in so many words, in terms of optimizing that balance. I mean, if you can get 235, 236, 7, 8, 9 people into an A321neo or MAX 10, you're going to do that. The human rear end has a great way of setting the entire economics for how you design an airplane, primarily because there are efficiencies that you get at 5 abreast, 6 abreast, 7 abreast, and so on and so forth. And essentially, there is effectively a curve that will give you a benefit in the middle, but not on either sides. And obviously, you know, you try to find the balance by not getting too far out. You're not at the A318 side of things, and you're not at the 757-300 side of things. And you try to find that middle ground. So in that, there is a, you know, they typically put them about 20% apart, 15-20% apart in terms of number of seats. So, you know, you're getting kind of a pretty long airplane north of about 230-240 seats in a two-class configuration. That's 6 abreast, I should say. That's a bit of a stretch. You know, again, on the other side of things, I mean, Boeing looked at a 757-100, which probably would have landed right on top of somewhere where the MAX 8, midway between the MAX 8 and MAX 9 today. And that would have, that obviously that airplane never came to be for a very good reason. It wasn't that efficient. It's carrying a lot of structure, on a per seat basis. So how you, you know, structure this again, you know, where you, if you're going to start a clean sheet program, you know, you're going to want to, you know, think about this, in terms of, you know, what's the biggest you can make an airplane before it starts the returns start to diminish. And, you know, within that cost, are you going for more range through an increased maximum takeoff weight, additional strengthening, so on and so forth? Or are you looking for essentially a 787-10 strategy, which is, okay, keep the maximum takeoff weight where it is, make it longer, trade payload for range, and be a people mover. Those are obviously bigger questions for those that design, build, and sell airplanes. But, you know, in that, you know, how wide you make the airplane is going to tell you a lot about where the increments are going to be.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, in terms of this, should we call it a spat between Bombardier and Boeing? What are the primary accusations that Boeing is leveling here? And why do they matter?
So there are really two issues here. The first one is whether or not Bombardier unfairly benefited from the support provided to it from the federal government of Canada and from the province of Quebec, and which gave the province a significant but minority stake in the C-Series program, and whether or not in turn, whether or not Delta was offered a price that was considered effectively market distorting and so far detached from what they would normally be able to offer the airplane for, had those subsidies not been provided. Effectively, was Delta, did Delta benefit from Bombardier price dumping the C-Series into the U.S. market to get it established? And fundamentally, Boeing argues that they were harmed by that. The 737 program has lost sales as a result of that, and that they deserve some. They want to have some recourse through the federal government in terms of a series of tariffs that would be placed on the import of a C-Series aircraft upon delivery to Delta or any U.S. carrier. And right now, it's, you know, that tariff preliminarily has been ruled to be hovering around 290 to 300% based on the fact that the Commerce Department said, yes, both of those things are true. They did dump aircraft into the U.S. market unfairly, and they were unfairly subsidized. So what we will see at the ITC is that determination of harm. Certainly, Bombardier thinks that it has not acted outside the normal realm of commercial behavior for an aircraft manufacturer. That discounts for large, established, desirable customers is standard practice in this industry. And certainly, you know, Boeing has behaved in much the same way, as has Airbus and as has Embraer. You know, you look to the pricing that Boeing offered on the 787 initially, that was significantly lower than its own cost estimates prior to the massive meltdown of its production system and its strategy for developing the 787. That establishing a new commercial aircraft in the market at blue chip customers like the Deltas, like the Qantases, like the Air Canadas of the world requires significant price cuts because you're asking a customer to take on the significant risk of a new airplane type. And what that means as far as the carrying the weight of that validation. So in that same vein, did Bombardier benefit from a bailout? Well, the reality is the C-Series almost killed Bombardier. I mean, they were having a major liquidity crisis around 2015 as they were shuffling their strategy. They've significantly cut their workforce to the tune of thousands of jobs all over the world at all levels of that company to make sure that they have a sustainable cost structure. But when you combine that with funds from the Canadian federal government to finish the Global 7000, and wrapping up C-Series, and what Quebec did to keep 30,000 employees at Bombardier at their jobs. I mean, I think a fair airing of that from an industry analysis and a trade perspective is that that was a bailout. That was to keep them above water. Would they have been able to survive without that? And there is a serious question about whether or not the market and market rates for capital would have allowed them to do that in a way that didn't significantly change how they are running their business. And so, yes, Bombardier appears to have benefited significantly from those funds, but did it necessarily change how they were pricing the C-Series and what and how they would have to behave either before or after those funds were conferred? That's for the ITC to decide, and that's what we're gonna hear. Tomorrow. But you'll be listening to this after the decision. So you already know.
Indeed. So in October, Airbus and Bombardier announced that Airbus was acquiring the 50.01% of the C-Series program for the pricely sum of nothing. What has happened in the months since then? Are we in negotiation time? Is this deal looking to go ahead? Do you think? What's your take on it?
Well, there are corners of this industry that believe that if the duties stick, then the partnership goes away. There is no immediate indication that would happen. Though the biggest, single most important development certainly is that Boeing and Embraer have officially confirmed that they are in merger talks. And this is a pair that's really been increasing their closeness from a technology perspective, from a defense side of the business, from the commercial side of the business. And these relationships go back, I mean, McDonnell Douglas days, as far as what Embraer provided to McDonnell Douglas as far as in-kind engineering labor on, I think that was the flap track fairing on the MD-11. I mean, that's how far back this goes. These guys have been working together for a long, long time. So the manifestation of that was not wholly surprising. You know, you saw the eco-demonstrator. I remember talking to Mike Carricker, who is now the chief 777X pilot, formerly 87 chief pilot. And it was right after Embraer and Boeing signed an MOU, to work together on various areas of commercial technology. And I asked him what he was working on. He said, well, I actually just got my ERJ 135, 145 type rating. And I said, really? That's interesting. He said, yeah, you know, we're working closely on X, Y, and Z. And that really struck me at the time. That was a pretty telling fact as far as how these companies were thinking about things in the same way. And it's just incrementally increased and increased and increased to the point where now we have talk of a full-on merger, a joint venture. But within that, you get a really new geopolitical dynamic, right? You get a transatlantic union between Canada and Europe. You get Canada, Europe, and the UK, obviously based on where we are with Brexit right now. And you get a North-South alliance between the US and Brazil. And over in Asia, you've got China and Russia working together on the CR-929. And on top of that, you saw that Italy and Russia, for a time, were working together on the Superjet. So it's not just that the business is international. The business is fundamentally now requires an intercontinental level of partnership that is an acknowledgement that one nation can't do it alone. And that is a kind of a maturing of a trend that really began back in the 70s when Airbus was first formed. But if the acknowledgement of that really makes this a strategic game that stretches far beyond, you know, fair commercial terms or behaviors as from a corporate perspective, because you've got these national assets in play here. Boeing is an extension of the U.S. Embraer is an extension of Brazil. Airbus an extension of Europe. And these are industries that are getting support on a strategic level from their governments, and they always have. And it's fundamentally the only way that they can compete with one another, because left to their own devices, there is not enough capital necessarily, whether it's political or monetary, available for these entities to compete solely on a free market basis. And that is a dynamic that is profound. And as China rises, is going to be even more disruptive. And ultimately, you know, how they compete as either a second or third player, depending on what happens between the duopoly. So it really is a, the landscape is, I mean, we are in consequential days here, truly.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely hear what you're saying, and I know that you're learning Mandarin.
Trying.
Thai Bangla. But yeah, it's what I find fascinating is that, I guess, through the 90s and early 2000s, you had Boeing in particular using a lot of the expertise in the four heavies in Japan, the four heavy industry companies in Japan, to produce significant parts of its aircraft, and it still does. Why doesn't that model work at the small end of the market? And or have we tried?
Well, if you consider the MRJ the small end of the market, they're going it alone. Or not alone, I should say. It's that they actually have Boeing's backing in a few key areas around part support and so on and so forth, but with, you know, Western suppliers very much as a part of development. Because guess what? Western suppliers are invariably a part of aircraft development. You look any you know, US, European, Japanese, Chinese program, et cetera, relies on a global supply base. That's just a fact. But why hasn't the market worked on that end? I think a lot of it, the way it's been kind of described to me, is that the economics of building regional jets is really, really, really tough. From an outsource perspective or from a rate perspective, it's the numbers don't line up. And actually, what's interesting is that, and I'm going to get the components wrong here, but I know that the Japanese heavies do a significant portion of Bombardier's regional lineup. And I can't quite remember which parts. It might be some fuselage parts, but that they have been at that level. But primarily, they really feathered their nest as a supplier through Boeing and the relationship there. I mean, the you know, corporate Japan is all over engine manufacturing, other different areas of componentry that get far less attention than, say, you know, the wings of the 787. So they are on a lot of different programs, but at the same time, the economics of how you build a small aircraft at rate and make money doing it also tends to lend itself to some extent toward keeping a lot of the control yourself, which is what we see in the Embraer model for mm-hmm. how they build their airplanes.
Now, when Boeing went and I guess not really announced that they were talking about acquiring Embraer, but certainly the Brazilian government seemed very surprised that was the case, given that they have a fairly large holding in the company. Was that true? Did that actually? I mean, I keep looking back and saying, did that actually happen? Was it a colossal misstep? Was it some part of a wider play around the politics in the matter? What went down?
I don't know the answer to that. Is the most candid answer I can give you. But what I do know is that there has been a move afoot for a while to try and adjust the golden share nature of the Brazilian government's role within the company. And within that, that was somewhat laying the groundwork for thinking about ownership structures in a different way. Joint ventures, whether either they were just on the commercial side of the business or more broadly on the ownership structure of the entire company, all pieces included, that could be with that golden share in play, you know, clearly there was an interest in allowing Embraer to choose its own destiny. Whether or not that was being done at the presidential level in Brazil, that's at this point it's not clear, but certainly there might to some extent be, you know, I the Brazilian government say I'm shocked to find gambling in this establishment, you know, when they wake up one morning and realize that these conversations are being had. Certainly domestic politics are a powerful thing, and you know, this could very much go in any number of different directions, but the reality is that Boeing and Embraer want to work together, and they want to take on Airbus and Bombardier together. Whether or not there's a joint venture or a merger, everyone has shown their cards about who they want to be working with. And that is going to shape the map also, just inherently in terms of who stays out of whose pool when it comes to cooperation, sales campaigns, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth.
Now, I guess one of the things that people have been talking about with the Boeing Embraer type is that it's some kind of acqui-hire, right? So Boeing gets involved with Embraer so that it can, really take the pool of trained aircraft designers and move them on to work for sort of more core Boeing products, as it were. What's your take on that? Is that accurate?
Well, there are two things at play here. One is a demographic challenge at Boeing. A lot of the engineering workforce is retiring. And so you need young, busy engineers. And there are or engineers who want to be busy. And one of the reasons that the E2 came in under budget as it was expected to was, number one, because of the exchange rate. Number two, because the exchange rate benefits you tremendously when it comes to the fact that you're, you know, paying your employees in reals, but you're selling your airplanes in dollars. So there is definitely a benefit that Embraer had there. From an acqui-hire perspective, Boeing has found ways, some expected, some less so, to try and learn the lesson of the 787. And that experience in developing that airplane so profoundly guides how the decisions that they make today. And the reality is they don't, for a new airplane, you don't want to go out and say, okay, let's get another Vought or another company that has not done the type of integration work required to do an all-new airplane. That went, you know, okay, yeah, you know, hey, we'll offer you the lowest bid at the lowest cost, and we're going to get it done on time, and it's going to be great, awesome. Oh, you don't have an engineering department. Okay, that's going to be a problem. You know, it's they don't want a repeat of that. And so they're looking for partners that can provide engineering, but also understand the secret sauce of how to integrate an airplane. And guess what? The number of companies that know how to do that with a commercial aircraft, you can count on effectively one hand. And you know, that talent pool and the expense of doing it makes a lot more sense from a strategic perspective, as it's described to me, through working with Embraer rather than going out and finding first tier suppliers. I mean, I remember a conversation with Fred Corrado back in 2015 or so, and I asked him. I said, Fred, do you want to work on a new Boeing airplane? And he said, we would. We don't have a project right now. We want to be a genuine partner with Boeing. We do not want to be a supplier to Boeing. That tends to be where you run into the political element here about how Embraer wants to be able to determine its own future and whether or not the Brazilian government allows them to do that or acts as a strategic governor to that ambition. Again, more open questions, but you know, how this unfolds is really, again, going to decide what the next 10 years of this business looks like and beyond. I mean, we don't have a new aircraft program from Boeing after 2021. We don't have a new aircraft program, even a new derivative from Airbus after about 2019. So there is a really, again, that landscape is changing and it's shifting almost day by day.
Yeah. And it means that we are in this absolutely fascinating period for commercial aircraft manufacturers and manufacturing. I'm hearing all kinds of fascinating things that are coming out of both Seattle and Toulouse. And of course then the other cities as well. I mean, you've got the cabin thoughts that are going on in Hamburg around, okay, how do we plan now for what the airframers may be doing in 5 to 6 years is absolutely fascinating. And there are a lot of really smart people thinking a lot of really smart things about it. But it is still at this stage, people gazing into their crystal ball and trying to figure out what happens. So, yeah. Well, thank you, John, for gazing into your crystal ball, because that is it for today's conversation. We certainly hope you enjoyed it, and we are always keen to find out what you think. Please feel free to email me at john@runwaygirlnetwork.com with any suggestions. And thank you to our guest, John Ostra. John, where can our listeners find you?
You can find me on primarily on CNN Money, so that's money.cnn.com, or on Twitter, a little more unfiltered, at John Ostrower. So that's JONOSTROWER, John Ostrower on Twitter.
And as ever, you can find me on Twitter at ThatJohn, and everything from RGN on Twitter at RunwayGirl and at RunwayGirlNetwork.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts, and thanks for listening.